It's religion today, it's ideology today, and our secularist friends also have a faith.
Some kind of Disneyland fantasy.
I know how this is going to get heard in the secular world.
The pseudo-Christian masks are off.
That's nonsense, ladies and gentlemen.
Apologetics isn't just about giving answers to other people's questions. It's also about learning to question other people's answers or even question the question itself.
In a Christian worldview.
Welcome to Quantum of Solace, number 98. Here we go again. There are just so many stories and so little time. But let's just go a little bit back on where we were last week. We were talking about Donald Trump. Are you not fed up hearing about that again and again and again? Isn't it fascinating that in British news, the American president seems to be the number one item all the time? He must be loving it. If you're a reality TV star, getting all this real TV. Wow. But so much, as we say, going on, and unusually for a politician, he's been doing what he said he would do. And there have been protests in Britain, and there was the Women's March and so on. And as we predicted last week, guess what? The British press and the American press hugely covered the anti-Trump Women's March and barely covered the anti-abortion march. Fascinating. That's where we're at. We live in this post-truth, self-confirmation, alternative fact society. And that's why we're here, to try and help you work through some of this mess. Now, we have a fascinating clip, and it is from The Guardian, which is a liberal, intelligent newspaper. It's the newspaper of choice of most social workers, academics, and so on. And it has recently been increasingly advocating anti-democracy. Now, what do we mean by that? We mean that because the liberal values they so espouse have been challenged in the US and also here, and they're beginning to lose, they're beginning to advocate what sounds like fascism. Well, have a listen to this clip.
When they go low, going high is not enough. Let's get this straight. In principle, it's never okay to hit anyone, Nazi or otherwise. But when Richard Spencer was punched while giving an interview in the street, it was a cathartic moment for many. A lot of us find ourselves at a loss for how to respond as frightening and dangerous views are suddenly not only being aired, but mainstreamed. Unable to adjust, we continue to engage with these views like they were just a new school of controversy. The world had changed, but we hadn't caught up. That punch? It caught us up.
When they go low, we go high,
said Michelle Obama amid the rising ugliness of Trump's campaign. Well, going high doesn't always work.
This is journalist Nazreen Malik.
Some positions simply cannot be entertained, let alone argued against. There is this fallacy on the left around reasoned debate. Don't assault and boycott racists and misogynists. Debate with them. Don't go low, go high. Be better. But why? Why should we be better? Just for the sake of being better, or because being better produces results? This philosophical Achilles heel is paralyzing liberal democracy. Would I encourage people to go around punching Nazis? No. But I will also not condemn them for doing so. The punch was a calling out after a time when too many things were not called out for what they really are. Going high might make us feel good about being the better party, but it is not a suitable response. And it doesn't work, particularly now while we face a clear assault on hard-won freedoms and equalities.
Okay, that is both chilling, it's easy to mock, except for this. This has been put seriously. This is not a parody piece. This is a woman who, in the name of liberal values, is being touted on a major newspaper website defending violence against people she disagrees with and telling us that there are some views that are so horrible they should never be allowed to be expressed, telling us that the way to deal with those who you disagree with is to assault them, mock them, lock them up, or whatever. This is the anti-democracy that we need to be very careful with. Now, you'll notice what she says is,
would I encourage people to go around punching Nazis? No. But I will also not condemn them for doing so.
She's not telling people to punch right-wingers, but she wouldn't condemn them for doing so. That's a bit like a fascist saying, I'm not telling people to beat up black people, but I won't condemn them for doing so. You can imagine the outrage and the horror that would come from that. But what a most fascinating phrase she has in there as well is when she talks about the narcissism of good behavior.
There is a narcissism of good behavior that needs to be jettisoned.
That is a brilliant line. Oh, being good is so narcissistic. Let's be wicked. Let's be evil.
There is a complacency born out of a combination of shock, privilege, and inertia that makes some think that keeping the dignity of liberalism intact will somehow shame bigots into behaving. The alternative to all this futile false equivalency debate is simply to call everything out and protest it, boycott it, march against it, and never let it settle.
It was C.S. Lewis who said that the fascists of the future will be the anti-fascists. We said this is exactly where it would go. And even as we record this, the University of California, Berkeley, have had to ban Milo Yiannopoulos, the infamous alt-right gay Jewish icon. Can you imagine this? That a homosexual activist who is Jewish has been banned from an American university. Imagine the uproar if it had been, you know, far-right supporters, white supremacists who had done that. But no, because it's people who dress in black masks and throw firebombs and so on. It's okay. Seriously, this is just absolutely insane. The other thing that interests me is, you know, the peace, love, and understanding generation. Why are they defending violence just now? Why are they rioting on the streets? You know, if Hillary Clinton had won the election and there were riots on the streets from white supremacists, you can imagine the horror, the shock, the despair, the pontificating, self-righteous, sanctimonious editorials in newspapers and so on. So why are some of the hard left now, or I don't even want to call them left, think liberals, I'm reluctant to use that term, but why are they justifying violence? And I'll tell you why. Because they're losing power, and I think they're more bothered about that than they are about anything else. And I think their principles are very, very flexible. And also, they've worked themselves up into hysteria. And when you get hysteria, when you get prejudice, and when you get intolerance, you're inevitably going to end up with violence. Now, I don't care whether it's of right or left. That's irrelevant to me. I care that it happens at all. And I'm not sure that I look at the kind of hate stuff that goes on Twitter or Facebook and social media, and that I can divorce it from reality. I don't think I can. I think the social media mobs of the 21st century easily lead into violence. And this podcast has given some examples of that. Now, Christians, on the other hand, we don't resort to violence. Oh, I know that there are exceptions, and I know that we can look at examples in history, but overall, our way is not the way of violence. Our way is the way of peace, and our way is to advocate through reason, and our way is to follow Jesus Christ, so that if Caesar happens to be on the throne, or Nero on the throne, or Trump on the throne, or Cameron on the throne, May on the throne, Sturgeon on the throne, whoever, we don't advocate violence. But what we do advocate is that we urge prayer for all rulers, and we encourage all rulers to follow the ways of the King of Peace, Jesus Christ.
Thank you. Today I am keeping another promise to the American people by nominating Judge Neil Gorsuch of the United States Supreme Court to be of the United States Supreme Court.
Judge Neil Gorsuch, I think is how you pronounce his name, who's President Trump's nominee for the Supreme Court. Lots of people are delighted with that, and lots of people are furious. Well, I don't know. But it's very interesting that there were Democrats who automatically are just straight going to oppose.
Weren't you just saying the other day that you need to resist before you know anything about the guy, his background, any decision that he has written, anything about him? Just the generic guy, should we resist?
We need to resist President Trump's extreme views. And so right now we need to know whether Justice Gorsuch whether he believes that the government belongs in a women's doctor's office when she's making a decision about her health care, whether the government belongs in a patient's bedside who's terminally ill. He has written a lot about opposing the right to die for terminally ill patients, and people want to know.
What are human rights? Is there a right for the child in the womb to live? Is the child in the womb a human? We have here a really interesting clip from somebody who is asked the most basic question about the taking of human life. We can't play you the whole thing, but we'll play you some of it.
Well, he actually hasn't ruled on any abortion cases, but he did write in a book of ethics this, and I just want to know if you agree with this or not, and I'm quoting him directly. All human beings are intrinsically valuable, and the intentional taking of human life by private persons is always wrong. Do you believe that?
All human beings are intrinsically valuable. However, Roe v. Wade says that a woman has a right to make a decision about her own health care.
Okay, but I'm not asking about Roe v. Wade. I'm asking you to assess what he has said here, not about Roe v. Wade, but just a general statement. All human beings are intrinsically valuable. You agree with that. The second part is the intentional taking of human life by private persons is always wrong. Do you agree with that or not?
Two of the most personal decisions a person can make is a woman with her doctor about her own body and a person who's terminally ill about whether they want to die in peace. And he has chosen that the government should intervene.
Are you going to answer my question? The intentional taking of human life by private persons is always wrong. Now, if you can't agree on that...
The Constitution says...
I'm not talking about
the Constitution.
What do you think? No, I'm not talking about women's rights. I mean, intentional taking of human life by private persons is always wrong. That's what he said. And I just want to know if you agree with that statement or not.
What he has shown in his legal career...
Are you really afraid to say the intentional taking of life is wrong?
No, of course not. I was a prosecutor. I prosecuted people for intentionally taking life.
But you won't agree with this because you're afraid of the abortion lobby. And like, ooh, you're anti-abortion if you're against the intentional taking of human life. I mean, come on.
I believe a woman has a right to make her own decision about her own health care.
Do you think it is the taking of a human life, abortion?
I think that right now, at viability, before viability, a woman should be able to make her own decision. After viability, in the case of her own psychological health, in the case of rape or incest, she should also be able to make that decision.
Okay, but is it the taking of human life?
That is a woman's personal decision.
Okay, what do you think? Do you think it's the... I'm not asking about the decision. I mean, is it human life or not? What do you think?
She is terminating something that she does not want, and that's her own choice.
Okay, but do you think it's human life?
I think at viability, a baby... should be decided by the woman. She's the one who has to have it.
But you brought it up. That's why I'm pressing you. But do you think before viability it's a human life or something else?
I think it's not viable yet, Tucker.
But it's a human life.
Courts have decided.
You're not going to answer my question now or ever, I suspect. But you should, because it's a basic question, I think.
Not telling you, not answering. Go to the blog page and you will get the full link there. Because here's the thing. Here's the link between our guardian speaker and our Democrat speaker and abortions and all these other things. The link is simply this. They presuppose that their values and their rights are universal and everyone else's is wrong. They don't justify them intellectually. They don't justify them empirically. It is just out and out bullying that they engage in. And I say that whether they profess to be liberal Christians or whether they profess to be progressive politicians. The same thing applies. You see, one of the problems that's going on here is that people now self-select stories. People don't think. People choose stories, choose friends, choose sites which reflect their bias and prejudice already. So we've got a classic example. Donald Trump sacks his temporary attorney general, who's going anyway, for refusing to implement or saying what he was wanting to implement was illegal. People, you know, are up in arms about that and defending her and so on. And yet these very same people who are up in arms about that, when the Kentucky law clerk who refused to process same-sex marriages was fired, they said, good, she should be doing her job. And of course, you can reverse the scenario. You can have people complaining on either side with that. And I think it just goes to show that it's this alternative facts. Alternative fact, you know what alternative fact means? Alternative fact means the facts that I don't agree with. It's not whether they're facts or not. It's like truth, post-truth. Well, it's true if I like it. If I don't like it, it's not true. This is the chaos into which we are going. However, not everything is going one direction.
After 3 years of what the church has called shared conversations involving clergy, laity and bishops, today's report lands squarely on the status quo. The bishops have decided not to change church doctrine, asserting that marriage is a lifelong union between a man and a woman.
So much to my astonishment, the Church of England, House of Bishops, upheld marriage. Why should that even be news? You'd expect them to do so. Actually, I didn't expect them to do so. But they did. They upheld the traditional, the biblical view of marriage as between one man and one woman. And this has caused a tremendous stouche. But good for them. On the other hand, the Church of Norway has approved a same-sex inclusive liturgy. Well, I'm afraid they are moving further and further away from what the Bible actually says. But having said that, last week we praised the BBC, and again we're going to praise the BBC. Because as part of the Church of England report, they were also looking at the issue of homosexuality and people in same-sex partnerships and clergy and so on. And they did a marvellous interview between Martin Bashir, their religious correspondent, and Ed Shaw and Sam Albury of Living Out.
Carrie Baptist, yeah.
He was doing the hosting, of course.
A committee meeting at Living Out, a new charity that believes the church's discussions about sexuality have been simplistic and unnecessarily polarised. Ed Shaw is a trustee and a member of the church's ruling General Synod.
Most people thought that the debate in the church over homosexuality was between traditional homophobes who'd never met a gay person and loving liberals who had loads of gay people in their church.
Isn't that what it is?
No, it's not. And I am, you know, somebody that society around would label accurately in some ways as a gay man. But the other part of my story is I've grown up as a Christian, and I've grown up as somebody who believes and trusts in Jesus, and who believes and trusts in what Jesus says about sex and sexuality, which is it's for the lifelong marriage of a man and a woman.
For those who don't know, Ed Shaw and Sam Albury are great guys. They would identify as same-sex attracted. What our society calls homosexual, though they don't use that term.
On the whole issue of culture, the person I want to follow is Jesus. And Jesus, when he was asked questions about sexual ethics, went back to the foundation documents of the Bible. He went back to Genesis. And yet he said, look, this stuff that was written centuries ago is the thing that should define how followers of God should act today.
Aren't you on the wrong side of history here? The courts in this country sanction same-sex marriage. As a former Prime Minister once famously said, isn't it time to get with the program?
The program I want to get with is God's program, because throughout human history, human beings have most thrived and have most done good to themselves and to the world around us, when instead of following cultural trends, instead of going with the various sort of waves of history, have actually gone with the program that has been wonderfully determined and set out by God in Jesus Christ.
And the interview was totally brilliant, and they're explaining how they, as same-sex attracted men, want to remain faithful to the teaching of the Bible. I wish that other people would listen and learn.
The ultimate problem in the Church of England is that there are radically different views on this issue, and asking people not to disclose those views at the point of ordination won't solve that issue. I think if you're going to be a minister within a denomination, you need to affirm the beliefs of that denomination, and at the moment that is still the official position of the Church of England.
In just over 2 weeks, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, will open General Synod, and the Church's shared conversation is likely to erupt into a public debate between seemingly irreconcilable positions on same-sex marriage. Whether he can hold the two sides together is likely to be the challenge of his tenure.
That's the kind of problem that you get in the church when we follow the culture rather than proclaiming the word of God wherever the culture goes. And we see that continued in different ways. So, for example, the whole transgender thing. Now, you're saying, oh, come on, not again. And the answer is yes, again, because our newspapers are full of it and our media is full of it again and again and again. And you keep thinking, we can't get any madder, right? We can't get any crazier. Yes, we can. The BMA, the British Medical Association, have issued guidance to staff saying, this is real, it's not made up, it's not a parody, saying that they should not refer to pregnant women as inspectant mothers because it may offend some transgender people. This is Britain. in the 21st century, in 2017, and we told you 2 years ago where this gender revolution type thing would go, we are now at a stage where people who've got university degrees, who are intelligent people, are advising doctors and their staff not to say to the woman who comes in for a pregnancy test, oh, by the way, you're pregnant, and not to refer to her as a pregnant mother. I presume pregnant person would be fine. Are there words to describe that level of insanity? I will leave you to work that one out. But there was a superb link that we'll put on again on our website from Peter Saunders of the Christian Medical Fellowship about transgender reversion. What about the harm to people who've had transgender surgery and so on and then want to revert back? Again, just an aspect of this debate that doesn't get looked at in the kind of sort of often monochrome. Let me return to the issue of democracy. This week in the British Parliament, the first steps were taken by Parliament, by a large majority, to fulfil the referendum decision. It was an interesting debate in some ways. I guess we'll have much more to say on it in the weeks to come as it plays through. But I was particularly struck by a comment by Nick Clegg, the former Liberal leader, who suggested that although the British people had voted for this, he was going to vote against it, and because he especially had in mind younger people who, although he wasn't saying that their votes were worth more because they were going to live longer, in actual fact, their votes are worth more.
They very deliberately decided to ignore the pleas, the dreams, the aspirations, the plans of the people who actually should count most, our children, our grandchildren, the youth of Britain, because they, no one here, no one on that front bench, they are the ones who will have to live with the consequences, which I will believe are fateful consequences, more than anybody in this house. Now, I know that the vote of a 19-year-old does not weigh any differently in the ballot box to the vote of a 90-year-old. But actually, when we search our consciences, as we were just being asked to do, I believe we should search our consciences, most especially about what country we think we're handing on to the next generation.
Very, very interesting thing. We used to live in a culture which valued the experience of older and wiser people. But now younger people. Do you not think that younger people have got less experience and are more easily influenced by those who teach them? And do you not think that teaching in our academic institutions is long away gone, moved away from teaching facts to teaching worldviews, teaching philosophies? It's little wonder that the majority of young people follow the ways that their teachers say. I was at a debate on education and religion in the University of Abertay this week. And again, it was just absolutely fascinating how so many of the students, it's kind of like they're monochrome. There's no diversity. There's no equality. It's all one view. Mr. Clegg's scenario allows for this kind of mob mentality, takes away any degree of wisdom, and allows for the elites who control media and who control academia to dominate. Well, I think there is a kickback against that. In contrast, let me mention somebody who I often disagreed with, but who is one of that rare breed now, a principled parliamentarian. Tam Dale, the MP for West Lothian, who was a pain to many of the people he opposed. I remember especially his dogged questioning of Prime Minister Thatcher on the sinking of the Belgrano, his dogged questioning in terms of what became known as the West Lothian question.
That it is deeply wrong to try to pretend that Scottish MPs should vote decisively in English affairs.
Scottish MPs could vote on English health matters or other matters like that, but English MPs could not vote on Scottish ones, and he was predicting the trouble and difficulty that would come with that. And turns out that he was right. Now, what fascinates me so much is not so much his political opinions, but his consistency and his willingness to go against the party line and his ability to think and to rationalize and to articulate what he thought. We could really do with a whole lot more politicians like that.
I feel rather in the position of Cassandra. Do you remember Cassandra? Cassandra warned the Trojans of impending doom. The trouble was that nobody believed her.
And then
in 2016, the board warned that 3 minutes to midnight is too close, far too close. Since then, inaction and brinkmanship have continued. Saber-rattling and the rhetoric and loose but dangerous rhetoric have become almost commonplace.
The doomsday clock.
To convey its concern about this unique moment and issue a call to leaders and citizens across the globe.
Oh my goodness.
To put the world on a safer footing, the board takes the unprecedented step, the first time in its history, of moving the clock hand 30 seconds closer to midnight.
Lawrence Krauss, that kind of atheist scientist, and a few of his colleagues, they've got this clock, you see.
Today we move the clock a half minute closer to midnight. It is now 2.5 minutes to midnight.
That's 2.5 minutes to midnight, midnight being the human race destroying itself. And they moved it forward 30 seconds on the basis of Donald Trump and Brexit and other things. See, when we're talking about alternative facts and post-truth, this is an imaginary clock. It's like one of these children's TV programs. I think it was called Play Days or something when I was a kid, where's the big hand at? Where's the little hand at? And they move the hand round by hand. And that's exactly what they're doing here. So they've got this imaginary clock with imaginary hands moving towards an imaginary apocalypse. And people report this solemnly as truth and as fact. Oh, give me the Bible any day. We need to learn as Christians to interpret our history and our culture through the Bible rather than interpreting the Bible through our history and culture, because our history and culture is just going mad. And again, look, let us stick with this democracy thing, because Donald Trump, and in my view, unwise, badly implemented, temporary ban for people from 7 countries. I think it was wrong. I had an Iranian with me for lunch on Sunday, and banned from the US. I mean, I honestly think that's daft. I don't think it helps. But what I find just as daft is the people who are asking for Donald Trump to be banned because he bans people, and the marches and all the rest of it. Now, I don't know. You're really concerned about that? Really concerned about Donald Trump banning people from Yemen? I wonder, did you march when President Obama and Hillary Clinton dropped bombs on Yemen that killed dozens of women and children? No, that one passed you by. I wonder, were you in tears when Osborne and Obama and Clinton and Cameron urged and encouraged and did bomb Libya, turning it into a failed state, chaos, thousands of people drowning in the Mediterranean? I'm just wondering where your tears were then. It seems very easy and very selective to pick on one person, even if you don't agree with him. I don't agree with Donald Trump, but he's not my president. And in one sense, it's none of my business. Sometimes you despair at the culture of death that our society is developing. For all those people who mock the slippery slope argument, euthanasia, oh yes, you know, it's just about stopping the people who are, you know, people who are really, really suffering and they're dying and they've got 6 months to live and it doesn't go anywhere else. Well, we know that that's not the case. But it seems as though each week we're getting a more horrific instance. And I don't know if I've got one more horrific than this. Maybe the 14-year-old depressed Belgian teenager. But in the Netherlands, a Dutch doctor had to use physical force to ask the family to hold down a patient he was euthanizing who didn't want to be euthanized, and that doctor has been cleared by the court. Do you know, I'm going to leave you, but I'll leave you with one rather sad story. Can you imagine if somebody was stabbed to death because they were homosexual or because they were atheist by some religious militant? It would be all over the papers, it would be headline news, and I would be getting it. Oh, look, this is what religion does. And they say, we'd never get atheists doing that. Well, there's an anti-theist in Germany who stabbed to death a woman because when he went and asked her if she approved of gay marriage and she said no, he just killed her. Killed her because he was an anti-theist, and killed her because of her views on same-sex marriage. I wonder what our Guardian columnist thinks about that. Well, I'm not going to advise killing people, but I'm not going to condemn people who do it. No, I think she would condemn someone who did it. But I'm sorry, lady. When you begin advocating violence as a means of expressing yourself, who are you to say when that violence should stop? I think C.S. Lewis was right. The fascists, i.e. the brown shirts and the black shirts, the Mussolini-type fascists, the Nazi-type fascists, the people who seek to suppress other people and suppress free speech, I don't think they're going to be the right-wingers. They might be. That might return. But I think C.S. Lewis was correct. The fascists of the future, in fact, the fascists of today, are the anti-fascists. All I can say is, thank God for the liberty that the gospel brings, both to individuals and cultures. And God willing, may we see a return to that in the United States, here and elsewhere. God bless you all. See you next week.
Yo. We're part of a culture that really loves to hate us. Every chance they attempt to isolate and debate us. It's not that they don't like us, it's just they don't like God in us. It's common knowledge, and oddly enough, it makes a lot of sense to a lot of us. We completely understand because we used to occupy the same space and lived in a similar type state until we tasted of God's grace. So we continue loving this world that so easily rejects us and passionately press past the lack of their cultural acceptance. And as if there weren't enough problems for us gaining influence, we keep fighting over the issue of what's too worldly of a Christian to make a difference. So no matter how you paint it, or politically campaign it, whether you water it down and drain it, it's really all the same, ain't it? It's the same frustration, same constant segregation. Christians living like aliens, trying to relate with citizens of a different nation. What always makes for a better presentation than bark and bite is a proper understanding of living life filled with salt and light. So we walk this fine line of walking in light of God's kindness and live with a sense of worldliness without the fear of compromising. Loving God and neighbor until Christ comes to split the sky or die in a society hailing Jesus as Messiah. Yep.